It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CenturTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there. I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. It's getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine, and I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
Neither the creators nor podcasters for Forward Thinking are bona fide legal counsel. Consult a local artificial intelligence before participating in actions that may or may not result in legal consequences. AI crime may or may not be punishable in your quadrant.
Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, secret, secret, I've got a secret. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkebaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. So how's everybody doing today?
Not too bad. How about you, Joe?
I am doing wonderful because we have a podcast topic that I'm very excited about.
Very excited.
It's about breaking the law.
Yeah, which is the second time we have referred to that while we were in the studio.
And it's still funny to us.
Yes, yeah. It is.
And so it's not about the future of Judas Priest. No, I saw... I saw an
article...
All right,
yeah.
Oh, did you not get that reference at first?
Oh, no. I was just like, what is the future of Judas Priest? Can we talk about that today instead? Can we just scrap this entire episode about...
We cannot do that. So let us focus on what
somehow...
Because I don't have the notes on Judas Priest. I can't really talk about it.
I don't think that would be an incredibly fruitful discussion. No, instead I want to talk about machines doing stuff they're not supposed to do.
You mean like
breaking the law, doing things that are socially unacceptable.
I thought you were talking about like when my toaster burns the toast, but you're going a little further than that.
Right. Yeah, that's lame.
So this would be like my toaster going
not
on
criminal.
A three-state arson spree, burning down schools or something. That would be more akin to what we're talking about.
It actually would, because I want to ask a general question about where we draw the line for humans having to accept responsibility for what their machines do. Which humans have to accept the responsibility when a machine does something bad?
Sure.
And are any types of machines exempt? So this was actually inspired by some news stories I saw recently, but I want to talk about some hypotheticals first, and then we'll get into some really bizarre actual examples of what it looks like when a semi-autonomous machine does something not so cool.
Okay.
So let's say you are a roboticist. You enjoy building robots.
All right. I could imagine that, sure.
And the way you express this enjoyment is that you build a bipedal humanoid robot and program it to strut down the sidewalk, pushing random pedestrians into traffic.
Wow, that does not sound like me, but okay.
Are you sure? I've seen you pretty cranky some days.
Yeah,
what if that street were Twitter?
if I were pushing pedestrians into Twitter, that I'm all right with that.
Just right into the flow of the tweets. Yeah. They're falling into the birds. the bale whale falls on top of them.
But this example, this hypothetical example you give, where we have a person who has created a machine specifically with the intent of harming others.
Yeah, this is sort of a starting point because it should be obvious to everyone that the person who created this machine bears responsibility for what it does, right?
Right. Yeah, because they designed the thing to do exactly what it is doing, which is bringing people into potential life-threatening situations.
Yeah. I would call this sort of like the weapon orientation towards robotics. You're simply using the robot's body and programming as a weapon, not much different than if you're using a big stick to bash somebody on the head. It's just like a more complex stick.
Right. Mm-hmm. So in other words, the robot itself is not at fault. It's actually carrying out the programming of and the design for which it was built. It's really the person who was behind that design and programming who's truly at fault in this case.
And furthermore, the robot doesn't know what it's doing.
I mean,
it's not aware of the fact that it's causing harm to humans because it doesn't understand complex situations.
Right. Just as an industrial robot doesn't understand that it's building a car, it's just following a very specific set of motions that it repeats until it can't
Someone
do it anymore.
Stops it. Or like your Roomba doesn't understand that it's freaking your cat right out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have to assume these things, assuming robots don't have secret consciousness.
Sure.
I feel fairly confident with that. But.
Yeah. Slightly different scenario. What if you imagine the same thing I just described, but one person writes the code for a bipedal robot that walks around pushing people, but never uploads it into a robot body because this programmer wrote the program as a joke. Then another person comes along, takes that joke program, uploads it into a robot body, not understanding what it would do when activated. Who's responsible then?
So, this is interesting. I started looking into court cases for the closest approximation I could find for these kind of scenarios, because obviously we don't really have court law established for this kind of stuff because we're not quite there yet.
Yeah. But if you think this is something that, why are they even talking about this? It's never going to happen. Just wait till we talk about a few cases later in this podcast.
Right. And so some of the law I'm looking at, it refers back to gun laws, gun makers, gun sellers, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And the courts have found that gun makers and gun sellers can be held accountable for practices that could end up allowing guns to enter the hands of criminals or gun traffickers if they have not shown that they have taken the proper steps. If they have been negligent in some way or purposefully allowing this to happen, they can be held criminally responsible. So it would probably be a case-by-case basis. Let's say that we have this hypothetical situation you have proposed where someone has created a potentially hazardous program but not actually executed that program. Someone else takes that program and uploads it to a robot, not knowing what the program does. That would be something that would have to be decided within an actual case, right?
Yeah,
And I would imagine that it would be a very complicated, drawn-out case, pricey, a lot of different appeals, because the actual situation you've laid out here has so much wiggle room in either direction that it would be, you know, it's impossible for us to say what the outcome would be.
Oh, yeah. And it obviously depends on the amount of harm done.
Yeah.
But there are certainly, for example, involuntary manslaughter laws.
Sure.
Which means that you are still responsible for someone's death, even though you completely did not mean to do it.
Yeah. It's establishing the level of accountability. And, you know, whether intent was there or not there, it would be it would be a complicated case, but I imagine that ultimately both parties would be held responsible. Both humans in this hypothetical situation would likely be held responsible. To what extent would depend upon the actual parameters of the situation.
Yeah, okay, here's another one, a third one that would be sort of analogous to the way we have to ask questions about weapons that exist today. What if one person builds and programs a pushing robot and sells it to somebody else, and then the new owner releases it onto the sidewalk and it does its thing? Who's responsible then?
I think both parties would be held responsible. I think actually this one is way easier than the first hypothetical situation, because you have someone who has designed a device specifically to put others into harm. There's no other reason for that device. Like, it's not a tool used for anything else.
Okay, sure. This is a special concept because there aren't really that many people pushing robots around right now. But in the incredible future, when we all have robots that are capable of pushing people.
Sure.
I don't know. It's a complicated and big question. And I would suspect that the maker of the object could, you know, make any number of arguments about the actual purpose of the object, and that it would be the person who sold the dangerous thing and the person using it.
Well, I can see your argument. I can see your argument, because you could state that there are a lot of things out there where the person who created it could argue their way out of the, you know, like, I just built this thing. I didn't put it to use, and it wasn't my intent to have this be something to harm, you know, innocent civilians or whatever. But in this particular hypothetical situation, it's hard to imagine a world where someone couldn't successfully argue you built a robot with the specific purpose to push people.
Well, let's make it more complicated.
Okay.
Then.
Yay.
Because this was, we just started arguing about what was supposed to be the really easy, obvious example. Let's say you build a bipedal robot that is simply designed to walk forward on a flat surface. It's not designed to hurt anyone, and in fact, it has safety measures in place that are supposed to keep it from hurting anyone. But the problem is, the person who programmed its walking behavior did not write very good object recognition or collision detection code. So it walks down the sidewalk, occasionally accidentally pushing anyone who gets in its way. Is the programmer criminally liable? Could this be considered criminal negligence if someone's hurt?
Probably not criminal negligence, at least not right now. I mean, if you look at correlatives in other industries, this would be something akin to a defect, and you could pursue civil cases against the manufacturer, programmer, etc. You would actually have to identify which parties you would want to sue in pursuit of getting damages from whatever this, you know, entity is. And I would imagine it would follow that same route. So you wouldn't be able to necessarily sue them, or you wouldn't be able to pursue a claim of criminal negligence necessarily. But you might be able to say this defect in this device led to injury, suffering, therefore I'm going to ask for some form of restitution on that.
Mm-hmm.
And liability would certainly still be on the side of whoever made the thing in that case.
Yeah. And again, I do think that it probably depends on the severity of the damage done.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Especially if you're talking about like lawsuits or something like
right,
that.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, let's muck this up even further.
Okay.
Yay!
One last hypothetical before we get to the real examples. What if instead of one programmer, many waves of graduate students and professors in a university artificial intelligence lab work on various stages of source code for a robot that is designed to find the safest and best way to navigate a busy sidewalk? And over time, this robot gets very complex. It's a very complex piece of artificial intelligence. Its navigation decision-making is displaying unexpected emergent behaviors the way we would expect any highly advanced artificial intelligence program to have. And in one particular test, it decides to kick a slowpoke out of the way. Now, it was never programmed to kick. In fact, you know, we can stipulate they put some kind of safety measures in place to make sure it didn't hurt people. But this program had enough complexity and freedom that it basically invented the move of a kick as a novel solution.
Sort of like how we talked about the artificial intelligence program that was able to identify what a cat was, define what a cat was by seeing enough examples of a cat. In this case, we're talking about an artificial intelligent program that comes up with a novel solution to trying to get through a particular...
Move around an obstacle.
Yeah.
Yeah. So an unspecified emergent behavior from this robot or computer program does something socially unacceptable.
Right.
Are the creators held accountable for it?
This one is particularly tricky.
Yeah,
right?
I think at this point we just burn all computers and go back to living in caves.
And it's possible that the only solution to this problem, and we'll talk more about this in a little bit, is to not when we get to this level of complexity, this level of sophistication, is to not necessarily look back on the people who made it, who designed it. This is where we start to perhaps discuss the possibility of extending some form of the concept of personhood to robots, meaning that you'd have to have some form of liability upon the robot itself, which usually, I mean, you'd think like, well, how do you hold a robot responsible? I mean, you can't punish a robot. You can't, you know, you can't go after a robot's bank account. A robot doesn't have a bank account. So in this case, you would have to create a whole new type of industry, essentially robot insurance, which would cover this sort of thing. And you would end up having the robot insurance would have to be the thing that would cover that liability. And in fact, this is something that people have honestly and seriously suggested. And we'll talk more about personhood in a little bit. We're going to discuss a specific implementation of robots and robot intelligence in the form of autonomous cars, a subject we've talked about a lot on this show.
Yes, and which is more practical than the walking robot that we have been using as an example here.
Right, right. So the kung fu robots will take a back seat, figuratively speaking, in our autonomous car, and we will discuss personhood with that. But we've got some other things to talk about first.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, there were a couple of news items I saw recently that made me want to talk about this subject in general. And they were both examples of where computer programs, and, you know, we've been using the word robot or bot kind of loosely. You know, there are embodied robots that have some kind of physical form, but we could also just be talking about computer programs.
Right.
So these are computer programs that one way or another violated conventions in a way that was unacceptable at some level to law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So one of them is a shopper bot that bought drugs.
Okay, wait. You're going to have to go a little more further into detail.
Yeah,
okay. So we want to go back to last year, to 2014. There were some Swiss artists based in London that called themselves Median Group Bitnik. I hope I pronounced that right. It starts with an exclamation point before the Median Group.
Okay.
And they conceived an art project exploring the existence and implications of underground marketplaces on the deep web. So I think they were sort of trying to get at what it means that we have these just continuous ongoing underground markets for illicit goods.
All right.
And they created a program called the Random Darknet Shopper. It is an online shopping bot. It's a computer program that once a week goes into a marketplace on the deep web. Brief side note, Jonathan, explain the deep web in less than 100 words.
All right. So it's theoretically the untraceable, anonymous web where you can do clandestine things without having all your online motions tracked.
Right. So if there's an iceberg that is the World Wide Web, the part poking out the top is Google, Yahoo, all the normal stuff we do. And then below the surface is this massive hive of scum and villainy.
Well, it's not, I would argue it's not as massive as what the iceberg example would have you believe. But yes, that otherwise is accurate.
Okay. Anyway, so backing up, this computer program once a week goes onto a marketplace on the deep web with $100 worth of Bitcoin to spend.
Okay.
And it makes a random purchase each week.
All right. So okay. What are some of the purchases they've...
Well, yeah, here is a sampling of some things the random darknet shopper randomly bought.
Uh-huh.
fake diesel jeans.
Of course.
Okay.
A stash can that looks like a can of Sprite. I believe a stash can, I think, is to hide drugs or other illicit substances in.
I would imagine
or
that you are correct.
Jewelry, if you don't want robbers to find your jewelry.
That is a very good cover story, Lauren. Also, it bought a Lord of the Rings ebook collection.
Okay.
Yeah, which you might store your e-hobbits in,
maybe.
I guess.
A baseball cap with a hidden camera inside.
Of course.
Some Nike shoes.
Right.
Yeah, all right.
It came up with a fake Hungarian passport scan.
Wow.
10 packs of Chesterfield Blue cigarettes from Moldavia. And
all right.
Here's the big one. A packet of 10 120 milligram tablets of MDMA. That's ecstasy.
Aha.
And so the all of these things, I believe, were delivered by the sellers to the artists.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were displayed at an art exhibition about this shopper at Kunsthalle in St. Gallen called The Darknet, From Memes to Onion Land. And that exhibit was open through January 11th, 2015. So they had to know, the artists had to know when they made this Darknet shopper, that it was possible, maybe even very likely, that this shopping bot would buy something illegal.
Well, yeah, I mean, the one of the things, I mean, it's they're looking at underground markets.
Yeah.
Right. They could have had it go on Amazon if they had wanted it to bring back nothing but chocolate and, at the very worst, like, novelty sex toys.
Right.
Yeah. Though, you may note from the things I listed that while most of its purchases were somewhat sketchy, most of them also were not illegal.
Mm-hmm. And there are many not illegal things on the deep web.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, one of the things we like to mention is the fact that while there are plenty of examples of illegal goods, people using the deep web for purposes to, you know, illegal purposes, that's not the only reason. There are plenty of people who are just very concerned about their privacy. They don't want their purchases tracked by people. They want the freedom to be able to shop without any kind of supervision, whether it's corporate or government or whatever. And it has nothing to do with trying to shop for illegal goods.
Yeah.
Sure. But I would guess that probably the artists in question were sort of hoping.
I mean, it's hard to speculate, you know, we can't really know, but yeah, they must have known that it was highly possible would buy something illegal, even though they never explicitly told it to do so.
Right.
So what's the deal? Are these artists criminally liable in countries that have drug laws against buying something like MDMA? And should they be held criminally liable in such a case? I mean, putting aside whatever you think about drug laws and all that, just mm-hmm. assuming this program bought something that's against the law.
Right.
Should the people who created something like this be punishable under the law?
Right. Considering that assuming, of course, that the shopping truly was random.
Yeah.
That there was no way to direct said shopbot to go for anything in particular. Is it the fault of the programmers if the shopbot actually does buy something that is illegal? And that's a complicated question.
Yeah, I mean, it would be almost like if you created a bipedal robot with a sack full of items and then sent it down into the street with instructions to barter with random strangers. Now, what if it came back with some drugs or some illegal guns or something?
Right.
I mean, what would you think then?
Well, and part of it may just be that this is the sort of stuff that's decided upon in court cases, right? It's not like that we have an answer right now where we could say, oh, well, this is clearly X, Y, or Z. This is something that ends up getting decided after long, drawn-out court cases. And also, it could even be that we ultimately see something where anything that doesn't have any agency of its own, like it doesn't have the ability to make decisions on its own in a conscious way, it's truly following as close to random action as you can determine. It may end up being that if it makes contact and purchases illegal things, that the accountability shifts to the person doing the selling of that illegal substance and not necessarily the buying.
Mm-hmm.
Although, again, there's also the question of what did the people you know, wherever that stuff went to, what did the people do with that? Yeah. Now, in this case, we're talking about an art show, right?
Right, and that complicates it even further. So there were a few opinions I came across in The Guardian. They had an article about this event, and the writer of The Guardian article got a statement from somebody in Great Britain from the National Crime Agency who basically said that this kind of thing would have to be assessed on a case-by-case basis. It's so weird and unusual that you kind of would just look at the individual circumstances. Though as things like this become more common, it seems like it'd be harder to try to make up a new way to apply the law every time you see a case like this.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that eventually the law would catch up.
Yeah. Fusion.net also had a good article about this where they talked to a University of Washington law professor named Ryan Callow about the legal outcome of such a situation. And Callow made an interesting distinction between the way the law is written.
Right.
And so Callow was talking about the difference between laws that are written in such a way that they explicitly punish reckless behavior versus laws that explicitly call out intent. And that's how it is in the United States.
So in other words, if I were to create a program that would specifically go out and find illegal drugs, that's very clear. There's an intent there.
Yeah.
If I create a program that it doesn't discriminate on whatever is being sold and therefore could buy illegal drugs, or it could buy a bunch of ebooks of Lord of the Rings, then that would fall more under the reckless behavior, depending upon what environment I set that shop bought out in. So in other
right.
words,
it would depend on the phrasing of the statute itself.
Sure. Yeah. If the statute is to guard against reckless behavior, and I release a random shop bot into a target rich environment in which there's a lot of illegal activity going on, there's definitely an argument to be made that I was acting recklessly and therefore am liable in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if it were more on the intent side, that would be a lot harder to argue.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to read, a specific sentence from a quote from Callow, was that he said, "Wanting a bad outcome doesn't make it illegal. You cannot wish someone to death. But purposefully leaving the bot in the dark net until it yielded contraband seems hard to distinguish from intent."
Right. So, in other words, if you were to look at let's say that we were able to see a full timeline of this project from the point when the programmers release the shop bot to the point when they conclude their experiment. If that experiment were to go on for several weeks and it only stopped after the ShopBot bought the drugs, that at least is somewhat suspicious, because it looks, and it may not be the case, but it looks like they were waiting for it to get one of these hits. Mm-hmm. And then they said, all right, we got what we wanted, stop it.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the timeline was. When you gave that list of things that it bought, I don't necessarily know that that was chronological.
Oh, no. I put the MDMA tablets last for effect.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know in what order they
right.
arrived. That,
so,
you might actually be able to find that out on their blog, though.
And if it were something like in week three that hit, you know, it ended up purchasing the drugs and then they continued for another 6 weeks, then you could say, well, there's no, you know, it's harder to say that that was specifically what they were trying to achieve, because it kept on going and the selection involves more than just this one hit on illicit substances.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, one of the creators actually gave a statement to The Guardian where they said that we are the legal owner of the drugs. We're responsible for everything the bot does as we executed the code. But this was the qualification. One of the creators said, "But our lawyer and the Swiss Constitution says art in the public interest is allowed to be free," which is kind of a totally separate issue.
Yeah, it's almost like we got to get out of jail free card because this is done in the name of art, which I think can only go so far.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because in January of 2015, after the exhibit concluded, the artists uploaded an announcement to their blog, and they basically explained that Swiss officials had seized their exhibit. So they came in, they announced that the authorities came in and they confiscated the exhibit. Presumably, they said, to impede an endangerment of third parties through the drugs exhibited by destroying them.
Yeah, saying that we are convinced that it is an objective of art to shed light on the fringes of society and to pose fundamental contemporary questions.
Yeah.
I'm curious what contemporary questions they were posing.
Well, I mean, on one hand, they may have been intending to bring up this very question we're discussing today.
And that is what I suspect overall.
In which case, they got an answer.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, mission achieved.
And also, I mean, if the Swiss authorities waited until after the exhibit was basically over, then I say good on all parties. Like, you know, it's they stopped the illegal behavior before it could cause potential harm to anyone. And also let us have this wonderful discussion about drugs and robots.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's another story that came out just in the past few months that's kind of similar. So, in February of 2015, a Twitter account named either Jeff Ebooks or Jeff Rebooks, I've seen both. I think maybe one is the handle and one is the name on it.
Okay, sure.
But it was a Twitter account. I'll call it Jeff Ebooks because of my love for horse ebooks.
Okay.
Which I think it might be a play on. A Twitter account called Jeff Ebooks was used to make a statement that sounded like a death threat. So while the owner of the account was at a fashion and cosmetics event in Amsterdam, the account Jeff Ebooks tweeted, "I seriously want to kill people."
Yeah, that does sound rather threatening.
Mm-hmm. A very sad fact about the internet and humanity is that this should come as a surprise to no one that a Twitter account made a death threat.
Sure.
But what is a surprise was that the Twitter account that made the threat was not operated by a human. It was a bot account.
Oh, I thought what you were going to say was going to be a cat.
No.
It does sound like something a cat would say.
Oh, a cat would totally say that.
No. Cats make so many more death threats than humans. Their eyes are just emanating death threats,
kittens,
beaming out.
Kittens think of nothing but murder all day.
But this was a bot, so what was the... So was the bot meant to just make death threats?
No. Okay, so it was an account run by a piece of software. This is what we mean when we say a bot account. And the account was owned by a Dutch web developer named Jeffrey Vandergoot. But Vandergoot did not compose or intend this tweet. And an interesting thing happened. The authorities took the online death threat seriously. So the police contacted and questioned Vandergoot, and they eventually requested that the offending bot account be taken down, and it was. But what actually happened? Why did the bot do this? Was it like an evil Twitter bot psychopath?
Like cats.
No. It was not programmed to make death threats. That was not part of its intention at all. It was programmed to cobble together random sentences. Now, why would that work and how would it work? Well, do y'all remember the Facebook app, What Would I Say?
Yeah.
I don't know this one.
There's been a bunch of things like this over the past several years on the internet. I remember one from back in LiveJournal days when it would like something would cobble together a LiveJournal post based on a whole bunch of your previous LiveJournal posts.
Now, I will say that there is something similar to this that I did just last night, which was that someone posted a thing on Facebook where you use your phone to create a text message using the suggested word and you just press it 20 times in a row. And it creates a sentence.
What was
so
yours?
Mine was dark. Mine was, I am so much for the end of the end of the end of the end of the end. Like it just repeated
wow.
of the end at that point.
That's fantastic.
So it was apocalyptic in my case.
No. Okay. So
it's beautiful.
It's not exactly like that. What would I say?
So goth. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
Are you okay?
I'm fine. I'm just my tiny dark heart is made very happy by that.
I know you like it. I can tell. No, the Facebook app, What Would I Say? It took all of the text that you had entered on Facebook over some previous period of time, maybe since you had signed up, as a corpus. That's like an archive of text.
Mm-hmm.
And then it tried to make new sentences by rearranging words and phrases. So a couple of mine I went back and found when I did this years ago. One of mine was, "To be my life, we need a book of secret police who work in Ecuador and read the user's interpretations of warmth."
Now I remember this thing.
Another one of mine was, "Someday when you're off the force, hand me your badge. Here's your badge. Here's the weirdest thing."
That is a very mercurial, a sergeant right there in a police department. Hand me your badge. Here's your badge.
Here's the weirdest thing, though. I was like, that does sound like something
I would
say.
That does sound like you. Yeah.
Also, the last one I remember is that I had, I don't think I could vote for some busy hands.
I could see you saying that too, actually. Yeah. That, I mean, it would be a really strange context, but I went and found this app and ran a couple through just before we came into the studio here, and it brought back all three of those sound unspeakably adorable, which is absolutely a thing that I would say. Probably have said it before.
That's a Lauren sentence.
And another one. If anyone, I elbowed in the morning.
It sounds like you were about to complete a thought, and then you're just like, nah.
Well, a lot of them do end up like that. Yeah. They are these fragments, because the Facebook app was based on a Markov chain generator, which is an algorithmic program that takes fragments of sentences from an existing archive of text, mm-hmm. and then it pastes them together to try to make sort of coherent but random new statements.
Gotcha.
So according to a couple of reports, the app that generated the offending tweet was also of this kind. It was a Markov chain generator. So it was just taking the corpus of this person's account and creating random new statements by mixing and matching words and phrases. Here's the even weirder part.
Okay.
When the bot account tweeted, "I seriously want to kill people," it was actually in conversation with another Twitter account also run by a bot.
What?
So I think this may be the first instance of bot-on-bot crime that I can think of, depending on if you count all those, like, robot combat TV shows from the 2000s.
I also think it indicates that even bots find bots incredibly irritating.
Yeah.
although, actually, the Jeff Ebooks account was not in any real way tweeting an accidental death threat at the other bot.
Mm.
I mean, they were both bots just programmed to respond with random messages when tweeted at by a stranger, so they were basically playing spam tennis.
Gotcha.
Anyway, back to Vandergoot. Being interrogated by the police for a random tweet generated by a bot that Vandergoot didn't even create this bot,
mm-hmm.
by the way, must be strange. Statement given to The Guardian, Vandergoot said, "I told the police that I can technically see that it would be my responsibility since I started the bot and it's basically tweeting under my name. However, it is a random generator, so yes, it's possible that something bad can come out of it, but to treat it as if I made the threat does not make sense to me. I feel very conflicted about it. I can see their point, but it does not feel right to me that the random output of a program can be considered something I said."
Yeah, I can certainly see how you could argue, like, these are not my words. However, there's also the argument of, well, yeah, I did allow this thing to tweet out. I enabled it, but then, you know,
but
is that the same as actually making the threat? No.
Well, I mean, again, I would say that if it came to a court case, it would come down to whether or not, like how much harm was actually caused. Like if that bot had tweeted a threat like that to an actual human person directly, and the human person had been damaged by that concept, then that would be a legally culpable thing.
Yeah,
you know, and kudos to the police for tracking down death threats on Twitter. That's amazing. Like, that's the part of the story I'm most blown away by.
Considering, I heard that part and I was like, what?
Yeah.
I'm like, like round of applause.
Considering how many stories we've heard about people who have had to field this sort of stuff and the lack of response they've had from law enforcement, it is rather surprising.
Yeah.
Well, at any rate, it is, you know, these are very unusual circumstances, right? I mean, it's just one of those things, again, like you were pointing out, Lauren, this is the sort of stuff that we don't have the answers for because it is so new. It's the kind of stuff that courts are having to answer on the fly.
Mm-hmm. Although, this is certainly not the only time that two bots have gotten into a wacky bot war and cause some kind of mischief. My favorite story is not a criminally related story. It's from back in 2011. So these two Amazon bookseller bots got into a price war. Both were trying to sell an out-of-print copy of a science textbook. And One of these bots was programmed to stay 1.270589 times ahead of its competitor in price. Upselling in order to, you know, banking on the fact that it was a large seller and had good product. It figured that it could go that many times up ahead of its competitor and still sell stuff.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
The other bot was programmed to stay 0.9983 times below the first bot, figuring that it could just undercut by that much.
So the difference here, you can see if you were to subtract one from the other or you know, compare them against each other, you see that there's a bit of a favor on the overside compared to the underside. So what happened when these things were going up against each other?
Eventually, a $70 textbook wound up being offered for $23.6 million.
That's a...
Before both sellers realized this thing and went,
oops.
Is that what all these memes on the internet about the price of textbooks are about?
I would just say that this proves that knowledge is priceless.
Truly.
Ultimately.
Truly.
You are the first target of my pushing robot.
That's... I'm glad that we have a record of it on the podcast. That'll make That'll make the prosecution so much easier.
Well, we are getting into some really weird territory here.
Yes.
So I, for one, in the case of something like the Twitter bot from Vandergoot, would not feel comfortable holding the owner of this Twitter account liable for what the bot said, even if it said something really scary. In that case, since it's so random, there's not even really a likelihood that it would say something like that. It just seems like a complete fluke occurrence.
Well, and
it's a random combination of words that could be in any corpus.
You could also argue, I think, pretty effectively, that what it ultimately is a very sad commentary on the public discourse taking place over things like Twitter, where enough instances of this are happening where that could potentially become something tweeted out at random. Like it's almost like it ends up being social commentary, which of course doesn't help you in the individual judgment of who is responsible for this instance.
Sure.
But it points to a larger problem that goes well beyond artificial intelligence.
Sure. I think the most thorough argument you could put forth is that it was reckless of Vandergoot to put this bot out there.
Yeah, so I guess maybe somebody might say that. I don't know if I feel like that. I kind of don't. It just seems like it's such a harmless experiment to run a Markov chain on a Twitter account. I don't know, maybe if you're doing it from a Twitter account that's typically full of phrases and words that would make death threats.
Well, I mean, again, if you're just, it depends on from where the corpus is drawn.
Comes from. Yeah, yeah, right? Sure. It depends on your magnetic poetry set of what winds up being set on your fridge, of course.
Right. If it ends up being the equivalent of a Cards Against Humanity deck, then you're just asking for trouble.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. This is very strange. It's just very recently that we've started having technology that has the kind of complexity in its behavior that it's difficult to trace the output of the technology from the person who created or owns it. I mean, typically throughout the history of technology, machines have been much simpler tools. They very directly affect the will of the user or the creator. You know, a gun isn't really it's not likely to surprise you in what it does. It's probably going to do what you do with it. But
yeah,
if you create an artificially intelligent program, even one that's, you know, only kind of artificially intelligent in the way these things we've been talking about are, I don't know. It's strange. Emergent behavior can happen.
Yeah. Certainly things like unintended actions can be a result of that sort of thing where it is more complicated than, you know, pull this lever and this thing happens. Now we're talking about there's some form of randomness that's introduced. Not true randomness because we can't really accomplish that. But
some form of behavior that's abstracted from our intentions.
Right. And it can be effectively random. It might not in the true sense be random, but in every, you know, practical sense it is. And that's when we're kind of working our way back over to this idea of autonomous cars, because it's something we can easily talk about because it's something that is unfolding right now.
Sure. Okay. Well, let's look at autonomous cars. I think we've talked about it before. Feel free, either of you, to disagree, but I think the three of us are pretty well in agreement, from what I recall, that autonomous cars will probably mean fewer accidents.
Based upon Google's experience, assuming that that would carry true moving forward, I think it's a safe conclusion to say that, you know, there will be fewer accidents. The more autonomous cars we have on the road, the more we'll see the accident rates decline.
Right, right. And those experiments included, if you haven't listened to our prior episode a couple of years ago now on autonomous cars, the two accidents that at that time Google cars had been in, there were only two of them at the time that we recorded that podcast. I haven't heard about any more. And one was due to a driver of another car hitting the autonomous car.
Right.
And the second was when a person in the autonomous car had taken manual control.
Right.
Yeah.
So, pretty good track record so far.
Right.
I think the computers that drive these cars are going to be vastly superior to human drivers. The problem is you're just not as good a driver as you think you are. And yes, that applies to you. You think, yeah,
yes,
other people aren't as good as they think they are. You're not as good as you think you are. I'm not as good as I think I am. It's a problem.
Your reaction time is never, ever going to equal that of a computer. We have physical limitations on it.
Sure. But that doesn't mean that autonomous cars will never have at-fault accidents.
Yeah, it would be kind of foolish to make that statement, to say that there will never, ever be an accident in which an autonomous car was the principal cause of that accident.
Oh, sure, sure. Computers can make poor decisions.
Sure. And when they do, this is a big question.
Yeah.
Who's liable? The owner, the manufacturer? Could we say in some cases nobody's at fault? It's a weird question.
Oh, I am sure that insurance companies aren't going to like that last answer.
Well, the insurance companies, again, may end up coming up with a brand new model specifically for autonomous cars. There are some people who are calling for that to be the case. Now, granted, we're still at least a few years away from autonomous cars becoming a consumer product.
A thing, yeah.
Yeah,
sure.
I've seen some predictions as early as 2020. Mm-hmm. Others, you know, when 2000 came around, there were people saying, oh, not within our lifetimes. And now we're suddenly, oh, within the next 5 years.
Yeah.
But one of the people I was reading about, he's a lawyer, John Frank Weaver. He posted in Slate about this and said that we might want to, this is where we might talk about it, personhood, extend some concept of personhood to robots and hold the robots themselves liable. And thus insurance companies would have specific rates for robots, in this case autonomous cars, that would mean that if that autonomous car were to cause an accident, it would be counted against it in that respect. That's how it would be liable, was through this insurance. Now, granted, that insurance would be paid by the owner of the autonomous vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And the basic argument I've seen is that the belief is that the accident rates will be very low, so the risk for insurance companies will not be that high. Thus, it will actually be attractive for insurance companies to do this because they're going to make way more on premiums than they ever have to pay out. So the idea is that for insurance companies, this is a windfall for them.
I have feelings about car insurance companies, emotions even.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things we could say, certainly.
No. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I also have feelings. But in this case, it is an interesting concept. And saying that, you know, we could extend personhood to these autonomous cars, and keeping in mind, they are not intelligent in the way humans are intelligent, right? They are able to sense the environment and react to it, but they're not able to compose a thought the way humans can.
Sure.
And there are some people who argue, well, that why would you extend personhood to that? And his reaction is that, hey, we already extend the concept of personhood to corporations. Those are not human.
Yes, but on the other hand, I would think that there is a slight disconnect there because corporations, at least in theory, can be punished. And this sort of brings up the question that underlies this episode. Like, what is the purpose of holding someone legally accountable? What is the purpose of punishment? And I know there are lots of sort of philosophical theories about there where people differ, but I think a really common answer you'd hear today is that the purpose of punishment is deterrence. Mm-hmm. You want to discourage people from committing crimes by saying, well, if you do commit a crime, a bad thing's going to happen to you.
Right. And a corporation has just as much power to observe that and go, I guess we won't do that thing,
right,
as a single person does, because that corporation is being non-randomly, completely on purpose, we all cross our fingers and hope every day, run by people.
Right. Well, yeah, that's the thing. Now, this is another problem. Like, again, in practice, you might say that corporations can't be held sufficiently accountable. But at least in theory, they are supposed to be held accountable.
Sure,
they can
sure.
be punished by the law.
Right.
Well, in this case, here's my perspective, is that if we're talking about damages, like, for example, the autonomous car collides with another vehicle, mm-hmm. then in that case, I think people would argue that the insurance, the liability of the autonomous car, it would be on the autonomous car itself. The insurance would cover it. That would all be handled in a civil way, not as in civilized, but in a non-criminal
civil
manner.
Civil court,
yes.
Whereas if it were something that was more serious, let's say that it was an accident involving an autonomous car and a passenger or a bicyclist, or that there were injuries that were a result of this, and it would have been something that should it had been a human driver behind the wheel, it would have been a case of vehicular manslaughter or some other criminal act. In that case, I would argue that it would be most likely the courts would be looking into whether or not the manufacturer of the vehicle had in fact created a defective product, and therefore it would become more of a defective product issue and less of an insurance thing.
A fault of the driver,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or non-driver.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it seems in this case that the same principle we've been observing throughout this podcast in our hypothetical examples applies again. The simpler the instructions this machine is following, the easier it is to establish whether the creator or whatever is guilty.
Right.
Once when the behavior becomes more and more complex, mm-hmm. where it's more and more difficult to look at the code and predict exactly what this thing would do in any given scenario, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. It's again, I think that it would come down to potentially criminal negligence, probably civil negligence, because I believe that most of the time when, for example, a airbag malfunctions and injures a passenger
sure.
in a car, that's usually settled out of court.
It's a civil matter.
It's a civil matter.
Yeah,
right.
there isn't criminal liability in that case.
Right, right. And so I would assume that based on our current laws, new laws are probably going to be written that include this kind of civil liability.
Yeah, we usually see new laws built upon older ones, mm-hmm. right? We don't tend to see the reinventing of the legal wheel.
Yeah.
You know, it makes me wonder if in the future, as artificial intelligence becomes more ubiquitous in our lives, especially in robots, things that are actually embodied and can act in society and perhaps injure people, are we going to start having a legal profession that's like a computer motive analyst, someone who is an expert witness in court cases to look at source code and tell you about the motives of the robot?
I'm sure we'll see plenty of testimony.
To assess intent.
Yeah.
Basically.
Right, right, right. Your Honor, I do not think that the Roomba should be held liable for this cat's trauma.
Well, the person who created the Roomba, but yes.
Well, at any rate, so John Frank Weaver was arguing that we extend personhood to robots. Brian Sherwood Jones, who's a design consultant, disagreed with that and said that we have to hold people accountable for robot mistakes, not to ever have the robots have the point where the blame is on the robots, because his argument was otherwise it means that you have a mass evasion of responsibility. That being said, that if if I were to investigate this and I were to find that the designers, the engineers, the programmers, everyone did their due diligence and did their absolute best, and in all the testing, there was never any indication that some sort of emergent behavior mm-hmm. could result in this, how do I just end up saying, well, this is a faultless situation where someone was injured or damage was done to property or whatever, but there's no one at fault? I mean, I guess that would be the only other conclusion you could draw.
Well, you could. I mean, this would be a very weird scenario, but you could start to think about, once we achieve truly sophisticated artificial intelligence that's sufficiently abstracted from the intentions of the creators, would we have to think about the robots that had this kind of intelligence as like forces of nature, the way we treat a tornado or a wild animal or something?
So we would say it's an act of bot.
Yeah.
Gotcha. You know, I've got an idea. Let's create like a cascading series of laws that dictate how robots should behave in order to prevent them from ever causing harm to humans, property, or each other.
Hey, but we saw some emergent behavior in Asimov, didn't we?
What? Look, all I did was read the laws. I didn't bother to read the stories.
That's not true.
No, it's not true.
No, and those are flawed on purpose to make stories interesting.
Well, actually, it is a great example of exactly what we're talking about. This is something that has been bandied about in science fiction for decades very well, and it was very prescient, because it turns out that we're now on the cusp of having to actually create the legislation mm-hmm. that will guide us in the years ahead. And ultimately, if we said, all right, what does this look like 20 years from now, it's very hard to say, because we're still in that earliest of phases. But it is fun to talk about, and it's becoming necessary at this point. We've already seen some examples that show how necessary this is. It's just going to get more necessary as time goes on. Any last thoughts?
We are not lawyers and do not offer official legal counsel.
Or unofficial legal counsel.
Very good to say.
Yeah, we probably should have put that at the front. But
maybe we will.
Yeah, you know, maybe we'll just have that preface each episode. This has actually been a ton of fun to talk about. Joe, you were the one to suggest this topic, and it was amazing. So
yeah, thank you
very much. And of course, we're getting great suggestions from you listeners out there, and we want to encourage you to continue sending those suggestions in. We love to hear from you. We love to hear your thoughts on the subjects we cover. And, of course, we are happy to cover the topics you suggest in episodes as well. So in upcoming episodes, your suggestion could be one we talk about. We'll give you a shout-out and everything. So you should send us an email if you have any suggestions or questions or comments. That email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or drop us a line on Twitter, Google+, or Facebook. At Twitter and Google+, we are FW Thinking. On Facebook, just search FW Thinking and that search bar will pop right up. Leave us a message and we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC,
We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. It's getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine, and I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.